So today we're talking with Captain Weissen from the Swedish Armed Forces, and Daniel is also accompanying us. So I'm the only Irishman here, and I'm outnumbered by two Swedes. So let's see where this conversation takes us. I think there's a lot that we can learn from the military, and I'm always intrigued as to why soldiers will apply breathing. And a lot of the skills and traits that are found in the military are very useful for, of course, everyday life, for business, for sports. So welcome, Nicholas. It's great to have you here. And I think we'll have a great conversation. You know, we're just going to let it flow and see where it goes.
Yeah.
So we were having a brief chat just beforehand, and you raised a really important thing about the selection process that's used in the military. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we talked about the concept of soldier, and that sometimes we just feel that we think about the soldier, we have this idea of a soldier, basically from movies and literature and stuff like that. And that's not the average normal soldier. And so the soldiers are kind of versatile. They have this big difference between them, and they are selected. And that was also what I mentioned before, that there's a selection process that tries to suit each and every soldier to its position of that takes care of its capacity and skills that they have. So there are a lot of different kinds of soldiers and different kinds of position. But one common aspect is the need of the ability to perform under what we can say intense stress or really intense situations where everything that you do actually counts in some sense. So there's a huge variety.
And in terms of the selection process, does it always work 100%? Is it possible to nail that one, that you can use a criteria or a testing to get the perfect person for the perfect position? And the other question that I'm going to ask is, the ability to handle stress, is that a natural tendency, or is it something that we can learn with training?
Yeah. For the first question, I would say, no, of course not. It's just an estimation. You look at the physical properties. Those are the easiest to see. If you need to be able to run this so fast for so long, well, that you can really, really measure. But when it comes to mental parts or other skill sets, it's much harder to actually see what they will actually perform and do once they're in the position that they're placed in. So, but you get some say that it's basically not about selecting those who are best, but selecting away those who does not have the capacity to go there anyway. So that's one. And the other question was...
The question was stress handling ability. So say, for example, some people naturally have a good tendency to handle stress, that no matter what happens, they can remain clear-headed and focused?
I think that kind of stress management comes from confidence also. We do some training within the military that is labeled as stress inoculation training. And there are some extreme exercises such as conduct after capture, where you put people under an immense stress for some time, and they have to learn how to perform during that. But even in the everyday stressors, they are set in a situation where they are constantly learning, and just training is like the basis of military, and training actually adds to that self-efficacy and that sense of I can do this. And when you have the feeling of I can do this, it gives you also the coping ability and stress mitigating properties in that. So I think that during the selection process, they look about mental stability and personality traits. So those who are most prone to be nervous might not be selected or chosen. But I think that the stress management is something that also is learned and is growing. So it's not by nature given, even though there are some predispositions, of course.
So Niklas, when you've kind of chosen the people, what is the next step to kind of increase their stress buffer? What type of tools do you have? Do you use proper sleep hygiene, breathing methods, maybe cold or heat therapy, or what you said earlier? What is it that you do in the next step to kind of increase that stress buffer?
I think that what I mentioned is that we have this. First of all, I just came to think of something. I just want to say that I'm speaking now as Niklas Wiséhn, the person. I'm not a representative of the Swedish Armed Forces. We should have said that before. So these are my views. I've been as a psychologist and captain in the Swedish Armed Forces for over 10 years now, and I have a lot of experience in this area. So and that's what I'm drafting from right now. So with that said, I think that we are what we're doing here in Sweden, we used to have conscripts that came in and did this. We took the from the male population every year, we took soldiers and we put them into this, as we call it, lumpen, this where they have to go through basic military service. And now it's changed, so now it's voluntary, and you can apply for it, and it's much shorter time. It's like 3 months. But during that first episode that everybody has to go through, regardless if you want to be a pilot or a cook or anything within the armed forces, you do basically the same. And that's a stepwise process where you actually go through handling a weapon. And when you come to handling a weapon and shooting and marksmanship, breathing has a huge role. That's one of the things that I actually recall from my conscript time during the 90s. What was this term, SARA, is that for in Swedish now, sikta, andas, rikta, avfyra. It's translated to aim, sikta, breathe, aim a little bit better, and then shoot. We make them use skill sets step by step. So it's steps wise how they learned. And of course there are components, because we live in Sweden, it's a cold country. So we need to get used to the cold. So it's kind of environmental exposure during the, and a lot of stress, of course, of physical ability to carry on and to build endurance and such.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, and it seems to me that there are different type of stressors for the military. There's the physical stress that you put them through, but also the mental stress, which is maybe, like you said, tougher to handle, because the physical stress you can kind of measure a little bit easier. So you have tools to, I mean, the physical is a little bit easier, but the mental, so you know if a soldier is more ready to go to battle or in stressed environment.
What we started with, and I think it's almost 10 years ago now, was that we applied a concept. We don't have any like mental health 101 or something like that everybody goes through. Basically, the mental part is, I would say it has room for development. Also the physical part as well has room for development, because as we see within the military, as we see in lots of other area, is that the amount of knowledge and training that we need to get for a position is increasing, and the time is decreasing. So we have to make that equation work out somehow, but it's really hard to do that. What we did 10 years ago that was we adopted a concept from the US Navy called COSC, Combat Operational Stress Control. And it basically is a concept that divides mental health into four areas. Green, the green zone, that's where you're supposed to be. That's when you're ready to go out and face anything, really. And then we have the yellow zone. The yellow zone is when you have been exposed to some kind of stressor or some kind of a load that makes you a little bit weary, you're a little bit stressed, but with the right rest and recuperation, you will once you're back into the green zone. And we say that they should have an everyday performance, an everyday management, stress management and life that brings them from the green to the yellow and back. So it turns down in a circle. And then what we want them to observe is that when they don't come back, because if you don't come back to green after being in the yellow zone for quite some time, they can venture up to the orange zone. And the orange zone is labeled as the ill zone or injury zone, that they have some kind of a problem that they might need some kind of external support in order to handle. And then we have the last zone, that's the red zone. That's when something has really happened. We're talking about traumatic stress, when you get like PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder, or if you get so stressed out that you get burnout or deep depression. But that's the clinical zone. So what we're working with here is actually the three first zones. You have to be in the green, you will be in the yellow, we expect that, but you have to go back, and if you don't go back, it will add on, and eventually you will end up in the orange zone. And we try to make them self-aware of where they are so that they can see that, well, I'm not really back into the green, so I need to do something about it. And most of the time, I think that the resources and coping abilities to actually do that is within their own reach, but they need to acknowledge it first. And we use the exact same method now with the Swedish healthcare staff in one of our hospitals that worked during the pandemic at an ICU unit. And we just made the same idea for them too. You need to self-assess, and you need to self-assess every day to see, am I back in the green zone? If I'm not, okay, what can I do to make it a little bit closer to the green zone over time? So that's something that we're teaching them. And within the Swedish Armed Forces, it has actually become common knowledge. We have made these small printouts that they can keep in their bags and bring with them and keep it in their pocket, and everybody talks about it. So it's a really good concept. Also the Danish has it now, and so it's really good.
It's interesting that you actually try to seek out stress so you are able to handle it, but the important thing is to learn to recover, so you come back to the green zone. That's the important thing, which is very different from normal people and normal companies. You try to avoid stress all the time. So you're not trained in handling stress. You're training in avoiding it the whole time, which is basically impossible. So it's very interesting that you learn that it's a cycle. There's no, like, stress is okay if you can come back.
Stress is not just okay. Stress is essential. Yep. One of my favorites, Robert Sapolsky. I don't know if you heard of him. He says also he loves stress. Stress is the foundation that actually makes us tick every day. So, and without it, we would be useful. So I totally agree with you. We should not fear stress. We should acknowledge it, and we should actually see what is stress when it comes to actually bringing up performance. And I think that that's That's the hard part. I understand it, Daniel, that you have a history in sports. And without stress, you would never perform in sports. This inverted U-shaped curve when it comes to stress has become almost common knowledge today that we have this. First, when we get some, I should have had some pictures, but when we get some increased stress, we also increase performance, but then we get to a peak. And that's where we have our optimal performance. And if we increase stress even further, then we start a downslope. But we don't realize that most of the time. And this is the skill set, how to know when am I peaking? Because we think that it's a path that goes straight up. So I increase the stress, I increase performance, but we're starting this downward slope. So in order, it's really important to identify when is there enough stress and when it's too much stress. And I think that when we use this this zone, this cost model, we are saying that the green zone, that's the resting state, the yellow zone, that's the peak, and if you keep it that way, you will go back again. But if you cross that peak, the slide is down the other way, and that's not good in the long run.
Yeah, so you're very focused on calibrating stress. You kind of know exactly where the optimal state is. Do you have any objective measures for that, like heart rate variability or anything or is this just a subjective measure that you say that I feel okay, so to speak?
I've been working. I do research, and we've been working with a lot of objective stress measures. I think that they are sometimes. So a little bit too sensitive for confounders. So I have this watch, of course, and it takes a lot of measures, and you can take your heart rate variability with it as well. The heart rate variability has been used in a lot of stress research, but it's in order to really get a solid measure, you have to be like, I measure at the same time every day, in the same breathing patterns, in the same situation, because it's so sensitive that if I'm sitting up here in the loft right now, so if I were to go up to the loft and take my heart rate variability, it would be affected by me walking the stairs. So, but it's still a good indication, because if I get one measure at one time, regardless of all the confounders, and I get another measure at another time with all those confounders, I could probably say something about the two situations. Was that a low stress situation? Was that a high stress situation? So I think that we need to learn more on how to use that measure in a good way. I also have been looking at cortisol. Also there, I've been working with a company that makes mobile cortisol readers. So when I started to do research with cortisol, I had to collect saliva and send it to a lab, and it was really expensive, took really long time, but now we can actually do it out in the field. So also cortisol is very reactive, and it depends on the a lot of factors. So you need to take amount baseline measures and everything. So it's hard with the subjective, but I think that I think it's important to find objective measures and to maybe calibrate the subjective experiences towards those. So I usually use one scale that's called PSS-14 to measure stress, and it's a self-evaluating scale. That measure scale, and you can, if you use that one over time and you validate it through the biological objective measures, you can like fine tune your self awareness. So if someone says, well, and it also depends on self perception, what you were expecting of yourself as how in order to how to manage stress. So if you have this idea of yourself as an individual who is really resilient to stress, you will score lower on this self-evaluation because that enforces your self image. But if you contrast that with the biological measures, you can sometimes see that it doesn't really go hand in hand. And you can't have really high levels of stress hormones and say that, well, I'm super calm. But you can do the other way around. You can have really high stress levels biologically and say that you are, because that's my mindset and that's how I perceive myself, or that's how I want to perceive myself. So, but we can help people actually find their way. It's a little bit like biofeedback, and that's coming strong right now. You get the objective measure back, and you get to know what it actually is saying to you. So I think it's really it's important thing there, Daniel, that you need to fine tune your awareness of where am I? Am I at this peak or am I over this peak? And how do I know that? And if you look at you have to interrupt me when I'm speaking too long. if you look at person who is suffering from burnouts and their way back, one of the first thing that they need to learn is how to identify this upward slope. They lack the ability to identify the peak and when they've gone over it. So they've been over it for quite some time, and that's what's given them the burnout syndrome. Yeah. But they need to learn how to identify that. And I think that even though that's a clinical population, I think that we can learn from that we need to acknowledge our limitations. But not just limitations. It's not like we want to create a society of people who needs to be in the green zone all the time. And as soon as something pops up that is uncomfortable and it's nothing, I don't want to do that, it's not fun and everything, that is not a sign of severe stress or stress that is bad for us. We need to balance this endurance and hardiness and resilience.
Seems like if you're in a high stress environment, that's fine. If you balance that with adequate recovery, so you need a binary, so to speak, lifestyle. You don't want to be in a high or semi-stressed environment the whole time. You want to kind of balance that with recovery. So I think what you're talking about would benefit many companies to avoid stress and burnout, like because. And have a different way of viewing stress, not to avoid it, but be aware of it and be able to have tools to recover. And then what Patrick, I think, is expert in, once you've hit the burnout, what do you do then? So there's kind of two different ways, one to avoid burnout, but once you're there, and you seem to have many of the tools to kind of handle both of that, which would be beneficial in the corporate world.
Yeah, I think in the corporate world, one of the basic models that I actually use for when I do lectures to soldiers and outside is also this, you have these models called demand resource models. And in organizational psychology, they're quite common. And the basic assumption is that you have an organization that is about to perform something. And that's something... is the demands. This is what you have to do. And then you have resources to meet those demands. So if for example, if I work in a factory that manufacturing pink plastic spoons, and I get this order, we have to do so many plastic spoons, that's the demands. So then I will have to look at, okay, what's the resources? What kind of staffing do I have? What kind of machinery do I have? What kind of time do I have to perform this and everything? And if that balance is that, well, I have a little bit more resources than I have the demands. I got this order for 100 plastic spoons, but I have the capacity to make 150 plastic spoons. then it's everything is fine. It's good. I have more resources than I need. But once we get to this position where the demands are higher than the resources, then we have a problem. We have a problem with stress, because then we are set up for a situation where we will likely not succeed. We can succeed if we are adding resources. And how do we add resources? Usually we add resources. We can't bring out new machines. We can't fix everything that is static. So we bring out resources in our work ability. So we work harder, we work more, we work under more mental stress. So we're using up our buffer zone. And I think that's quite a useful model. And when it comes to the last year now during the pandemic, we need to add that these demands is not just the related to the outcome. They say we need to produce 100 plastic spoons. It's also the demands is what's happening in society, what's happening in my personal life, what's happening in my work life. How is will we produce those spoons, or will I have a work tomorrow? Everything adds up into this demand, and that calls for new resources as well. So new resources might be, how will I manage this? And I'm also scared all the time because I'm afraid that I will catch COVID, and that would limit me to use my regular resources. And that balance, having a view of that balance, and that's what we have been doing within the healthcare. We have been monitoring that balance over time to see when does that balance go over place, and when it does, it's really important that we do something to address it. And we can't fix everything, but when we address it, we are getting a little bit closer to a solution. And I think that that's one of the important parts. And the thing is, this is nothing new. This was actually done in an experiment in, I think it was in the US, in a factory that made rope back in, I think it was 1918 or something like that. It later, in the 50s, became known as the Hawthorne experiment. Mm. It's one of those basic groundbreaking psychological experiments where they changed the light bulbs in a factory, and then they talked to the staff and to ask them, okay, what is the optimal lighting? And they could see that whatever the performance went up. And the important part was not the lighting at all. It was the actually not just asking the staff, but making the staff important in some sense, actually putting the focus on them, listening to them, and providing them some kind of meaning. And we knew that, and it's over 100 years ago that they did it. And it has so little impact on the workforce today that it is like, why not? This is right, super simple to do, and it actually brings performance up, but we don't do it. I don't know why.
It's amazing, Niklas. I'd love to get a couple of ideas. Is there any tools? Stress is something that creeps up in us, and we don't necessarily know it, because I think it's like the frog that's put into the pot of boiling water. Well, when it's put on cold, the frog doesn't jump out until it's got too warm and the frog is cooked. With human beings, stress is just something that's innate. Is there a way, without filling out forms? We had a really good interview with Rob, and I can't pronounce his surname.
Certainly.
And the Swedish top 10 professional tennis player who retired back in 2010. And part of the reason that he explained why he retired was he was under stress, but he didn't realize it at the time and he didn't feel it. And I think we all fall into that boat. You know, and we have tools that we are using, and we are using breathing and sleep, which for me personally has been absolutely immense. You know, if I had this information back at university, it would have been a total game changer. If I had it in the corporate world, it would have been a game changer. Because number one is, I don't think we can have that concentration and focus of the mind unless we have good quality sleep. Yeah. And nose breathing is essential there. But coming back to it, is there a way to assess if we are stressed by having our attention in the body? Or is that any use?
Yeah, I think that there is a way, and I think that we've been touching on that, and I think that it is actually awareness. I think that awareness is what we have lost. I was listening to this, if you know him, Eric Popper.
Yes, I do.
Dr. Pepper.
Yes.
He's an amazing guy, really. And he also pointed out that most of our stress responses are actually survival, they're survival traits. They're there for us because we need them. We needed them during evolution. And now when this modern Western life, we don't really need them anymore, but they're still there. And they're making a mess all the time because the environment is so much information. So we get like this cognitive overload. We don't get that physical exercise that we need. We are messing up with nutrition. There's a lot of things that are stressing us apart from what we think about most of the time when we talk about stress, that I have too much to do and too little time. There's a lot of stressors going on. And I think that the key here is actually awareness. And sadly, I think that, it's my case as well, this venture into this awareness and self reclaim of a stress-free life comes from suffering. When you have suffered something that has made you, that is the awareness that you can't look away from. Yeah, you need to acknowledge it. And then you start to look into things. And that's how I ended up with the Oxygen Advantage as well, because I was started to look at how can I work with procedures that is calming my nervous system, that is calming me. If you get an imbalance between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, and it's like everything is, it's hitting the brakes and the gas pedal at the same time. You need to find this mental awareness. So I started doing both meditation, as I mentioned before, Patrick, I used the Muse headband to do meditation, because I'm not prone to do this 1 hour long mindfulness session. But so I used that, and I started with the breathing exercises, and I do a lot of physical exercise as well. And I think that that's really important. But back to your question, I think the key is awareness, and start to listen, and you in order to be able to listen, it's like if you're walking in the woods and you hear something, what do? You don't continue to walk and, oh, what was that? You stand still, you stop, and then you listen, because you want to reduce every movement of your own body, and then you put your mind to it, and what was that? And I think that we need to do the same in our everyday life, that sometimes we need to just stop. Whoa, what's happening here? What's this doing to me? Is this helping me, or is it not helping me? So that I think is the one of the key, just this basically aware. And you don't need this Apple Watch to monitor your heart rate. You don't need this cortisol test. It can be tools, basically, if you do in science. But in everyday life, you have to need much, much, much more aware of what, and that's why I think this scale with green, yellow, and orange and red has been so good, because I believe that it has created awareness amongst the soldiers.
I think what we're talking about here is interesting, because I think we're talking about explicit stressors when you don't sleep enough, you train hard. And what Patrick is saying, maybe some hidden stressors like everyday life that you don't even think about. And the good thing about Oxygen Advantage and breathing methods, it's kind of taking care of both, but it goes back to awareness. Awareness that you don't get enough sleep or you train too hard or not enough, but also the hidden stresses of life that you don't necessarily think about. Breathing will help many of those as well. And they're more subtle and they may not be as easy to detect, but with breathing, a correct functional breathing during the day, that will at least increase your stress buffer for both the hidden and the visible stressors. So I think, again, for me, breathing is very important because you can use it for various events and throughout the day. And sleep is a pillar, but breathing for me is very, very important to handle all these things. And hopefully we will see more of focus on breathing so you can take care of both the hidden and the explicit stressors.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree. And one thing that I also came to think about when I took the Oxygen Advantage course is some of the times we are working towards optimizing ourselves. Optimizing our performance. When I go to the gym, I try to optimize the movement patterns and how I use strength to perform an exercise or something like that. But I think that what we're into here, and what I realized when I got my really, really low ball score, is that for the average person outside, it's not about optimizing. It's about regaining normal function, and I think that's one of the things that once you learn something new, you start to look a little bit different at the world. And now I'm looking a little bit different to people to see how are they breathing, what are they doing. I've been mostly prone to musculoskeletal issues before. Since that's an area that I think is really, really interesting. And I can see that I have a huge concern for my kids that are actually in this snooping position all day with their phones and everything. But so what I'm saying, I don't want them to be athletes. I want them to regain the normal function that the evolution has made for us. And I think that when it comes to breathing, I don't think that the average person out there has ever put even a minute of thought that this automatic process can be just dysfunctional, but they still have a normal life. You need to just bring them back to normal. If you are here also with David Sinclair, this longevity professor at Harvard, he also say that the human organism, the body, we are evolved to handle different kinds of discomfort. And when we get discomfort, we thrive. We grow from discomfort. So we need to have some kind of discomfort. And when you experience air hunger, it's a discomfort. So we're experiencing discomfort, and the discomfort is bringing us to another level when we can handle that, when discomfort no longer becomes discomfort. And I'm not talking about discomfort like these groups on YouTube that seek discomfort and they jump out of airplanes. I'm talking about everyday discomfort that we can manage. If I go to the gym and do a heavy workout, it can still be something that I really enjoy. And I enjoy the feeling of being totally worn out. But it is a discomfort for the targeted muscles. And they will respond by coming back stronger if I give them the right amount of rest between the sets. And that's basically the same idea. So I think
it goes back to what you said. I think the whole key is being aware or conscious. Because if you train and you're conscious and your breathing obviously becomes faster, that is normal. But if you are unconscious at work or anywhere else and your breathing becomes faster, that's not a good thing because you're unconscious of it. So breathing again, being aware of your breath, that now it happens to everybody, but you're unconscious and then all of a sudden you're aware that your breathing has become faster. That is the moment when you kind of can slow it down and bring it back down again, because I think it's okay as long as you're conscious for a certain period of time. You can overtrain as well. Yeah. But it's all about being aware or not aware. I think that's the whole key.
Yeah, and I think that from that awareness, we gain control. And I think it was Wim Hof that said that we have to change the name from the automatic nervous system to the semi-automatic nervous system, that we actually can influence. And once we learn that, and as we talked about, Patrick, also when it comes to anxiety, when we come up to this clinical realm of problems, in anxiety, we have been using breathing techniques to gain control for several years within the CBT community, cognitive behavioral therapy community. But then it's just been a tool for that situation. Okay, when you feel your panic is coming, then you do like this. And this is different because I think that we can, if we regain normal function in everyday life, we will become less susceptible to everyday stressors.
Yes, Nicholas, I totally agree. And I think it has been overlooked. I'm coming back to the awareness thing because it's something that's kind of intriguing me. Could we say that there's three ways for somebody to bring awareness into their way of life? One is to monitor their thought activity. And when they notice that they're spending a lot of time thinking unproductive thoughts, to ask themselves the question, well, is my thinking being productive? What impact is it having on my emotions? So the first one in terms of awareness is to monitor what's going on in the head, because we typically don't. And the second one is to bring our attention into the body. That when we are stressed as human beings, we typically feel it around the stomach, we can feel it in the torso, and to become aware of that. And the third thing is, when we are stressed, as Daniel pointed, we do have faster and more shallow breathing. So there's three things there that, as a, you know, of course, people have their different lists if they're in the green or yellow or orange or red. But even if we were bringing in just observation of the mind, body, and breathing, that we may become sufficiently aware that we stop ourselves before we go into burnout. Because it's the person who's pushing themselves, and society is pushing us. You know, you talked about your young kids. Society is pushing kids to do well in grades, pushing kids to do well at university. Then they go from university into the corporate world or whatever chosen work they do. And there's stress all the time there. And, you know, sometimes I really wonder what's it all about, this whole push, 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 you know. Yeah. And I think it's really important that, and information technology has really messed this one up. You know, the amount of time, like three or four major companies who have literally got a monopoly on the human mind, because they are consuming so much time of people's attention. They are literally a leech on attention. And this awareness thing is good. As a psychologist, what would be practical tools? Would they be practical tools that you would say to your client, your students, or whatever?
Yeah, I totally agree with all of those three levels. I think that the first one that has to do with cognition and thought process, I think that that's where we are kind of messing up, because we are constantly overloading our brains with information. It's not just social media, it's information. And we lack the ability to be sensory deprived. When I was a kid and we were going to a friend that we had to take the bus, we just went down to the bus station and then we looked at it and said, well, it's 20 minutes. Oh, we have to wait for 20 minutes. Then we waited for 20 minutes. If we were lucky, there was this ad we can read or look at, but we waited for 20 minutes. But sure. Today, no one can wait. Even before they have nowhere in the bus is coming, they're putting up the cell phone and they're getting some kind of stimulation. And it's not just technology. The technology is just making the information available. But we get this huge overload all the time. And that's what concerns me the most. I was looking the other day on a TED Talk with Sherry Turkle from MIT. She is one of the, she's a psychologist, I think, and she has been writing a lot about this digital revolution. She started up with a book in 1995, I think, when the internet just came around, exploring the traps and the risks in this. And she said, and it was almost 10 years ago now, she explained the pitfalls of this for our young people. And when I looked at it, I felt really, really sad because, okay, now it passed 10 years and nothing of this has been put to use in schools or in everyday life. We're just continuing on the same negative slope. And I think that the hard thing here is it's not that it's bad. It's just you have to make limitations. How much you use it, and when it becomes used that you are seeking, that you want to use it, and take that in contrast to when is the system, if call it like that, making use of you. All of these, someone said that all of these free platforms, whenever it's free, you are the product. And that's a fact, really. So, and it's really, really hard. I try to inform my daughters about it. And it's really, really hard to put the phone away from social media when everybody else is on social media, because you miss out.
I think that is a big problem, which is different from 20 or 30 years ago, that it's not if you miss out and you miss out on the social connection. So if you're not in the loop, you don't have anything to talk about. So it's quite a challenge to tell people or kids to stay off social media, because then you that is what your friends are talking about.
Yeah. Then you will be like an outcast. You say, oh, she doesn't have social media, so she's not there. So you have to do that, and that's a hard thing to. How do we build some kind of counterweight towards that? We might need to accept that. Well, this is reality. We need to accept that as it is. But what can we do to minimize the negative impact from that? As for example, when we talk about Eric Pepper, he talks about posture. And how posture affects our mood. And if we have our kids today, or adults as well, performing much of their activity in posture that is biologically recognized as being depressed. Because when you are depressed, you have this hunched over position where you're like, oh, I'm not happy at all. And when you're happy, you're like, open up and we see that sometimes when people are trying to, if you look at young guys, for example, they walk down the street like this because it builds their body position and their body talk builds their self-confidence. So it's been known for quite some time, but we haven't realized that when we are positioning ourselves in this moody position, we're also telling the brain that you're not in a good mood. You're not in a good state. We don't have to be sad. It can still be super fun to watch all these TikTok videos, but we are placing the body in a negative position, and over time that will wear out. So if we can then try to straighten out, and if we were also, when we hunched over, we are limiting our abdominal breathing, and if we bring all of these, that's what I'm saying, all of these parts of the puzzle together, if we can do some kind of breathing exercises that brings also not just awareness to the focus away from the all of these thoughts, because when you're doing this slow breathing or this cadence breathing, you have the focus in here on what you are doing. You can't think about all this social media. You can't think about all this other thing. And you can't do it slouching like this either. So it brings a lot of other benefits in. And I think the key is to find, to put it in some framework that is so easy to do. I saw today that you actually made you said that this app was coming, Patrick.
You take our oxygen advantage app, yes.
Yeah. So if you make that's one way of using this technology to bring something that is useful, and the new generations are used to do things on the cell phones, and if we can bring it to an easy way to come to it, mm-hmm. it might be something that can be one part of this countermeasure towards all of these.
Nicholas. Yeah. If somebody is in the orange zone, and I'm conscious of our time here, if somebody is in the orange zone, would you prescribe or encourage them? Would you see benefits? And I don't want to put words into your mouth, in terms of breathing exercises and sleep, or what would you do? I understand that what we do is one component of it, and I think breathing and sleep, of course, are important. Would you prescribe breathing exercises, and what breathing exercises, what areas would you target in terms of breathing? Would it be reduced breathing? You mentioned cadence breathing there. Would you give box breathing? Would you do breath holding? Would you bring breathing exercise into physical exercise? I'm just kind of to get a kind of a snapshot.
Yeah, I think that sometimes I have this saying that the best training is the training that you do. So it's not always about what kind of training. It's that you lift your butt off your coach and do something. So I'm not that much of an expert in the breathing area yet. So say that, well, this is better than that one. But sure. I think that one needs to have a fair amount of discomfort. It can't be too much, because we are talking here not about the efficacy of the breathing exercises themselves. We are talking about what we call in therapy barriers to treatment. What are the barriers that will prevent the individual to do what is good for them? And if it's too much of an effort, we are lazy. If it's too much of an effort, we won't do it. Unless, of course, we are in a really, 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 really bad place, because then we want to do it, but then we need help right away. And if it doesn't work right away because we're in such a stressed place, then we don't think it's working. But it's not working because it's not working. It's working because it takes time for it to work. So I would say that box breathing is I think a great way to when you have this almost panicky attack. But for everyday stressors, I think that the goal might be awareness and focus, and just sitting with it, as I understand it, with the cadence breathing, and sitting there just poking with this how long is my inhale, how long is my exhale, and so on. I think that's a good one, and it's really easy to do. You can do it in basically anywhere. And you can do it on the bus, you can do it when you commute. It doesn't make any noise. If you have a hard time finding that space now I come home from work, I have to fix dinner, I have to do that, I have to do that, I have to be social with the family. But those are the things that you can actually fit into other areas in your life. And I think that's a start to become more aware. And if you are in the orange zone, you need something. And then the thing with the orange zone is that you might also need some kind of external coaching or help in order to go over these barriers to treatment. Someone that's a little bit pushing you.
Excellent, excellent. Daniel, I'll leave the last word for you.
Well, if you go back to Patrick's question, I think it comes back to awareness again. So maybe starting off, it's the actual breathing method may or may not be that important, because it's all a matter of being when you're stressed that you focus on your breathing or certain breathing techniques. As you become more aware, you're gonna have an interest in going deeper into breathing. So regardless of what you start with, it will take you down the road of learning more breathing. And eventually, I think some sort of progression is important to see as well. The frequency, intensity, and time will gradually increase. But to start the habit is, I think, the most important thing. And unfortunately, in our age, we speak about it, but I think it would have been great to see in schools, because that is where you really needed to start the good habits. And it's almost like you should have this little pling whenever you watch social media. It should come up, do your box breathing, then the kids would be, you know, more aware. So I think it all goes back to awareness of your breath and how you feel. So I don't know if you have any comment on that, Nicholas.
No, I totally agree, and I think also that there's a lot of things that should be added to the school curriculum. Basically, when they already have like physical education, PE, and instead of, I think it's important for them to do sports because it brings a lot of other areas. So you shouldn't replace that with some kind of other theoretical components. But I think that bringing this area into the curriculum should be just as good. Talk about posture and strain on the body, talk about the breathing, talk about nutrition, talk about all of these things that are bringing us away from our normal function. I think that's one of the key factors. And I think also, as you said, when you start up with something, and you feel that you are actually gaining some progress, you are getting some benefits from it that will enhance and motivate us to continue with it.
Excellent. Wonderful conversation, Nicholas. Thank you so much with your background. I think there's a few wonderful nuggets of information there that people can draw from.
Yeah, I hope so.
So much, Nicholas.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me in.